Okay, today is March 5th, 2020. This is an oral history interview. We are interviewing Academic Staff Award winners. My name is Troy Reeves from the Oral History Program, and we're here at the University Archives inside Steenbach Library. And we're here with Rick Strickland. So Rick, for sound quality purposes, if you would say your name and spell your last name.
Sure. Rick Strickland, and Strickland is spelled S-T-R-I-C-K-L-A-N-D.
Okay, great. I'm going to turn this up just a bit. You can speak at that volume that you just spoke at. I'm going to slide it just a little closer to you.
Okay.
And so, Rick, as you know, I sent you questions a few weeks in advance, or at least a couple weeks in advance, and those are the questions that we're going to go, and we're going to pretty much go in order, reserving the right, of course, to do follow-up questions.
Understood.
So, the first question, kind of a two-parter, which is what brought you to UW-Madison and the Carbone Cancer Center?
So I came to Madison, actually, this is my second time in Madison. I was in Madison for only a year on an interim role, and then moved to South Bend, Indiana. And the work that I have been doing for much of my professional career has involved working cross-culturally with multiple populations and working to find ways that the organization that I worked for might partner with those different community organizations and groups to improve health or social equity, to promote justice, has been core to the work that I do. I came to Madison specifically to the university to take a particular position. And the position was to coordinate the development of a program called Spirit of Eagles. And Spirit of Eagles, at that time, was a brand new national initiative to improve cancer outcomes among American Indians and Alaska Natives. And it was funded through the National Cancer Institute and was one of about 30 efforts across the country of differing geographies and differing populations. And this particular effort, as I mentioned, was with American Indians and Alaska Natives, and was national in scope. In my role, I was responsible for working with with American Indian populations in a five-state region, so including Wisconsin, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and Iowa. And I also had ended up doing some work in Michigan as well. So the work itself was not as much, my drive and my interest was not as much to the content of cancer. Cancer was the subject. It could well have been something else. For me, the notion was we were working with populations who were at a disadvantage, who had experienced cancer disparities, and we actually were at an early stage really trying to discover what was really going on in tribes currently and what was actually the case in terms of even statistical data about what kinds of cancer cases there were, and building that infrastructure nationwide.
So if I may, I want to back up one step here and ask how you became interested in the idea of sort of cross-cultural work or working for social equity.
Mm. That's an old story, Troy. I'm an old rural kid and grew up in a family that was a three-generation family. My paternal grandparents lived in my home when I was a child. And no one in my household ever graduated from high school. So I was not only the first to graduate from college, but the first to graduate from high school. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that these folks didn't know a thing or two, as we would say in the country. Mm-hmm. A couple of the things that I learned in that context is already in the mid to late 50s and early 60s when I was growing up, we were in a time when there's a lot of change going on in American life, and rural communities were changing rapidly, and it became clear early when I began going into school that these people who I loved and cared for a lot and who had invested a great deal in me, their ways and their values and even their economic status was kind of looked down upon. We didn't have very much money. And I kind of got to college partially because my father ended up getting a union job driving a cement truck. He had been a farmhand and a mechanic before that. And so I learned early on that some people had less and some people had more. And that didn't matter about who they were. That mattered about some other things that were external to them. Mm-hmm. And I was, my mother was a religious person, and I went to a Catholic grade school, and she taught me by her way and about respect and the importance of caring for people and taking them where they were. And that was reinforced when I was in my elementary school years. So I have a real foundation of looking at things that way. And then early in my early in my professional career, I had the opportunity to train as a community organizer. And this actually, I was working for a Catholic Charities agency at that time, and they wanted to train me and another person in those skills. And so our actual lead trainer was a member of IAF, the Industrial Areas Foundation in Chicago, which was founded by Saul Alinsky. Saul had already passed at that time, and man by the name of Chambers was the director. But one of the critical things about that is that you begin to look at the world, and you're trained to look at the world in terms of who has power and who has not, and what can I do to facilitate those who have the circumstance of less power to take that power in the, in their own lives. I'm not giving them that. I'm supporting them. And so that's a real critical difference, and it's key to the understanding of an organizing approach. So I guess I digress to tell you a story that comes out of my, my childhood and my early professional life. And a little later on down the road, I had an opportunity to do something called the Healthy Communities Fellowship, which was a national fellowship that exposed me to a curricula that included some really sort of cutting-edge thinkers about public health and the future and health promotion in our communities, and how health is really an outgrowth of one's social and economic status and access to care, and that health care lives inside that wider understanding. It doesn't rule it, it doesn't direct it, it's not the focus. It's a way to help us be well and healthy. And the way in which we're living our life becomes much more the driving factor. And so I learned there basically to use and understand the nature of public health from a justice lens. And so I adopted that language, and still do today, to talk about how do we help communities and facilitate communities in being as healthy and as sustainable as they can be. That's still sort of the cutting line on my resume. Mm-hmm. You know?
I forgot to turn the volume off of my computer, so let me do that so there's no chance of the music I'm listening to bleeding into our oral history interview. Thank you for that quick little break there. So to me, that sounds like that was a lot of, ended up being some answers to my next question, which is the primary factors from your past.
Yes.
But are there other factors from your work or your past that, leads...
Leads to Carbone.
Leads to Carbone.
Well, some specific things. I worked inside... when I went to South Bend, Indiana, I was initially a vice president of a local United Way. And my responsibility was in planning and in community partnerships. And that sort of theme of community partnerships is a critical aspect of the, of this sort of my professional life. And in that time, I began working primarily in African American and Latino communities in not only South Bend, but in the greater St. Joseph County area. And before that, I had worked in rural communities, which is a piece of my story. I'll return to that in a second. But so I think the things that came out of that experience in South Bend initially was the working with more different community populations, and being a broker. As a white man working cross culturally, and this learning about that, and there's trying to think about how to weave in a couple of thoughts that I have. Chronologically, the next step from my time in South Bend is after a half a dozen years at the United Way, I worked for the local community hospital system in that town. And that was the organization that supported that Healthy Communities Fellowship that I did. And I became involved in the governance of an internal fund that this health system created to grant back out to community groups to do health promotion work, not just disease prevention, but health promotion work in their community. And so I became almost like a grants officer, helping to support that. I was not the only member of that group. There were about a half a dozen of us in that. An excellent team experience. I want to weave back in a thought that I think is important about coming to Carbone. So the 2 points there is I expanded the number of groups that I and populations that I worked with, and I developed a language in by working in the health arena and with other colleagues who were health professionals, because that had not been my training or background. As a rural kid, I learned early on that I learned to translate. So I had never, as I told you, my family had not gone, graduated from high school. I can remember as a kid in junior high, sitting in a medical appointment of one of my parents, helping to translate what the physician was saying and what they were trying to communicate. Not because we were translating over language from English to a different language, but because of the sophistication with which the physician was talking. And always in those kinds of circumstances, it's good to have somebody else who's listening, period. At that point in time, it was also good for just simply pure understanding. So I learned early that I had a gift to translate, to sit on the boundary and potentially translate between two different folks. When I originally went to Minneapolis to work, which was my first real stop after graduate school, I had a mentor, and who one day basically said to me, you know you're a broker, right? And I looked at him and I said, what do you mean, Ken? And all he did was repeat it. He said, you're a broker. And I knew him enough to know that this was something that I should think about and take in. And about 6 months later, it dawned on me what he meant. Mm-hmm. And what he meant wasn't that I go out and raise money with someone with people's money. He meant that what you do is you build relationships across boundaries and try to find ways for people to work together. And that became really almost a self-understanding that sort of put a frame around what it was that I learned as a child growing up and then began to hone through a variety of different kinds of experiences, is this capacity to put one foot in one place and one foot in another. And the unique things that happen then in a setting like Carbone is that what's happening is you're putting yourself inside an institution that has a lot of wherewithal in terms of understanding and resources and information and money and skills and all of those things. And the question becomes, how do you help make that, help be a translator there? The Spirit of Eagles role helped me do that in many ways because it had three very simple, straightforward objectives. Everything that we did was predicated on going out and meeting tribal representatives across that region that I served and learning whether they had interest in potentially working with us or not, and figuring out how we could be of any support and what resources not only we could bring, but you could broker with others in their geography, a local hospital, a local university or college who might have something that would be of benefit. And what are they doing already themselves? You know, don't go with the assumption that nothing is going on. You know, go with the assumption that lots of things are going on and you just don't know. You know. In that framework of doing that, we had three objectives. One, provide education and information. The second was learn if there was any way in which they had questions that they were interested in learning more about via research. And then find ways to nurture the next generation of American Indian youth into careers of health as health professionals, as scientists, and even just simply getting themselves into four-year institutions. So that three-part mission actually was the foundation of Spirit of Eagles and ultimately became the foundation of the Cancer Health Disparities Initiative, mm-hmm. but simply for multiple populations. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the deal.
Okay. Thank you. So recently retired, and I know these next two questions probably depend on sort of where you were in your career here. Mm-hmm. But the first one I want to tackle is, when asked, how did you describe what you did?
Well, it somewhat depends on who's asking, you know, but somewhere in the conversation, I would have said, and I maybe even told the story about my mentor, Ken, saying that I was a broker. And one of the key things that I always attempted to get across to folks was that something I sort of said in passing a little bit ago, And it don't start with the assumption that you're the one who's bringing all of these wonderful, great, and glorious things, as wonderful and great and glorious as they are, to someone else. When you go to interact with across a boundary like that, you're going as a guest. You're invited. And so be a guest. And so understand the organizer who was the lead of this effort that went back in the day said, always ask about the pitchers and drink the coffee. So what he was saying is, you know, and you could use that as a tool, of course, but you'd be disingenuous about that, and that'd come through pretty quickly. But always ask about the pictures you see, because what is the life of the people that you're interacting with? You know, be curious, please. And drink the coffee. Accept the hospitality that's offered to you, even if it's not much. I still remember the day I walked into a farmstead. I drove onto this farmstead, and this was back years ago when I was working at Catholic Charities in Minneapolis, and I was doing rural community work. And I drove onto this farmstead, and ostensibly we've got a very nice house, multiple silos, a big barn, things look immaculate, and I'm going, and I know ahead of time that things are not very good economically for this household. And I go, and I meet the woman of the family, and then later her husband, and she invites me into her kitchen to sit down at a nice oak table, in a round oak table, where most everybody probably gathers in that house. And she asked me if I'd like something to drink. And I said, sure. And she gets up to go to the refrigerator, opens the door, and I happen to glance that way and see that there's absolutely nothing in the refrigerator. And I quickly say, you know what I really like is a glass of water. That would be perfect. Okay. So accept the hospitality. And I guess what I really say to people about what I do and have done is I really try to listen to people whose experience is different than mine and figure out a way, is there something that we might be able to do together that would build their capacity, would increase their access to resources, would help them ultimately achieve their goals and be have greater experience of power in their life. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. And that's what I'd say to you. Mm-hmm. If I'm saying something to responding to a faculty member, you know, who's asking me, you know, it depends on who they are and what their view is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we talked about this question earlier because you noted that since you've been here long enough in sort of different positions, that this would be different depending on. Mm-hmm. I want to give you space to talk about a typical day in sort of all the various hats, if you will, that you wore while you were here on campus. Okay.
Well, a typical day early on in my role at Carbone was very much about reaching out to local individual tribal communities and communicating with them primarily by email, but lots of follow-up by phone, to actually arrange time to meet them and then go out and set up and arrange for visits, and then to figure out a way to actually schedule those so that I could, because this all sometimes involved a flight, yeah, and a car rental, and multiple tribes on over a week's period of time. Mm-hmm. I was rarely gone over a weekend, unless there was something unique I was going to. So there were those kinds of setting up those kinds of arrangements. And it was just involved because it took the time to do that. The other thing that we worked on really quickly was working on providing some information about where can American Indian tribes, and most often in my situation, I was meeting with a health director, which is an administrative person responsible to the tribal government, who is their lead person for health. They're functioning as an administrator. They're not a physician or a medical provider. Sometimes I met also with a medical provider and a physician or a nurse or other people on that staff. But I always, from a protocol perspective, you would always begin with that health director. Because in effect, all of those other people work for that individual. And learning those kinds of protocols, is also very important. And I had a mentor of mine was Dr. Judith Cower. Dr. Cower was the leader of the Spirit of Eagles initiative nationally. She is one of just a handful of American Indian medical oncologists in the country. And at that time, she was based at Mayo Clinic, Rochester. So I'll stop on that point. But so early on, it was a lot about learning what those protocols were, building, reaching out, taking the risk, and then going and actually meeting with people, mm-hmm. hearing them, sending back to them, this is what I understood you said to me, or if they had some very specific things that we would follow up on those. I went, every time I went, I brought them something. And what I brought was, because that's something traditional that you would do, is if you were meeting with someone, is you would give them a gift. Well, my gift was a booklet, sort of like a compendium, like a notebook of resources and websites and access and individual people's organizational names and contact people that we knew were available in this region in terms of cancer information. So assembling something like that, and tailoring it to the particular state I was in was a part of that. Also at that time, I began building liaisons with other advocacy organizations like the American Cancer Society or other hospital entities or systems like the University of Minnesota Hospital and their cancer center, or the State Department of Health in any one of these states. And so those were all people that I began to build relationships with and identify what are you doing in relationship to tribal communities and reaching out to them and what kinds of programming are going on. And then, things just kind of begin to mushroom from there. And it becomes a very rich network of people and organizations. And then you start to think about, how do you leverage that? One other thing that was a part of that early part of that time was, I alluded to this early on in my remarks, but we didn't know a lot about what really was the case in terms of cancer rates in Indian country. And in part of that is because people didn't focus on it, hadn't looked at it. Okay. There's a great story about this. So Judith Cower as a person, as a physician and a leader in terms of American Indian health, cancer health across the country, was in communication with people at NCI. And they kept saying to her, you know, well, American Indian cancer rates are low. Judith kept saying to them, but I'm seeing all of these patients. And at that time, she actually was working directly as an oncologist in Bismarck, North Dakota. She hadn't moved to Mayo Clinic yet. And she said, I keep seeing these all of these patients. And so the dialogue goes on. And over time, it became clear that what was going on is that the National Cancer Institute was looking at national averages about, okay, and you can look at national averages and you can go out and look at them today and you can say, oh yes, okay, there's a lot of cancer, high cancer rates in white population, very high in the African American population, and most other ethnic populations are lower. And that's because they're looking at an average. But if you looked at that American Indian cancer rate and you looked at it with a geographic variation, you would now see that that average was really composed of great variation. So you had some very high rates in the northern plains of the United States and in Alaska, and now subsequently also in the southern plains. But you wouldn't see that in the Southwest. And the Pacific Northwest would be, oh, kind of average, maybe even a little less. And why that became important was simply because if there's not a problem, then you don't invest time and money to try to address the problem. Okay. And so this became sort of a major kind of area of work for us early on, because we began to ask the question, well, what's really going on, not only in the Northern Plains, but what's going on in the states we're working in? And we not only discovered that there was a variation by geography, but there was also variation by the type of cancer and the sex of the individual. And so you might have higher rates of the highest rates might be colorectal or lung cancer, but lower rates of breast cancer or prostate cancer. And then you also found that the rates for men might be different than they are for women. Okay, and so one of the things that students who worked in my unit, when they came out of that experience, every single one of them could repeat back to you, you know, if someone asks you what's the rate of cancer, and then you're going to say, well, where are you talking? What's the cancer? And what's the sex of the person? Because you have to do it that, you have to look at it that way. Otherwise, and that's really actually not just true of American Indians. It also is true, for example, in Asian populations. So Chinese population, very different than, and Japanese population, very different than more recent populations like the Hmong community. And so it's important, and some of that is also socioeconomically impacted. So we kind of got into the, looking at that data. So that was really very much a part of the first, I would say I spent the first good almost half of my career was really working in that, in those areas. And then we began in 2006 is when we started the Cancer Health Disparities Initiative. And that's when I not only continued the Spirit of Eagles, but became the outreach director for, we had an outreach director and a research director for the Cancer Health Disparities Initiative, and I was the outreach director. And that's also when we began to hire, get some additional funding in, and began to hire our first staff person, and then a second staff person. And I was the supervisor for those staff. Mm-hmm. And one of them was going to work on a rural-based project, and the other in an African-American project. Mm-hmm. And we also had, throughout this period of time, students with us in some capacity or another, either as a one-time course experience or as a student hourly. Mm-hmm. We also had interns who came on who sometimes between finishing their undergraduate work and moving into a health career would take a year and would become an intern on our staff. Mm-hmm. So then
I'm guessing, so once you moved into, I'm just going to acronym it as CHDI.
Right.
And started taking over supervisory roles. Mm-hmm. I assume that means that some aspects of your typical day changed.
They did. And fundamentally, I became also a supervisor and someone who was helping to write grants and raise money for those other program areas. To help to find direction for those areas, what else would be part of that? Yeah, those are pretty much the major things, help to develop program direction and strategize about how we could implement this particular program best. Mm-hmm. And mentoring additional staff people, they each brought their skills and experience and training. And we really emphasized that if you're going to work in that community, we want you to have some experience living or working in that community. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to work in a rural community, you need to have had some experience living or working and with rural people, because it is a different culture. Same is true in an African-American community. You need to have some experience. It just is really a leg up if you have some experience living and working, living or working in those communities.
So had you supervised staff and students before this position?
I have. When I was at Catholic Charities, I actually developed a rural outreach program for them. I began as a rural outreach worker and then developed a rural outreach program and had a staff person work with me at that time. I was involved in hiring as well and supervising. I really take that role very seriously. I consider my first responsibility is to advance that person and their skills and their future work. So mentorship is sort of the first responsibility from my point of view.
Do you feel that's because you had mentors in your career?
I think that that's a part of it, Troy. I think that it's also because I believe that we're nurturing these folks for where they're, whatever's next for them. And that next may not have anything to do with us, may not have anything to do with the work they're currently doing. But I'm interested in, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I will. I've been known to say, I'm in the business here to change the way you think. Mm-hmm. Okay? And to say that to staff, to students, part of my goal here is to challenge you. Part of my goal here is to expose you to things that you may not have thought about or looked at. And experiences you may not have had. That's my job, and that's not just for me. That's not just for the job they're doing now. That's for their future.
Mm-hmm. So then, Rick, as you moved in towards the end of your time here, mm-hmm. As becoming the director of mm-hmm. CHDI,
right.
Did that make a typical day change or what, you know, oh, yeah. what changes happened?
Oh, yeah. Well, when you are the sole director, it's, you know, I had, my colleague and I had built, because we were co-directors with primary focus, different primary focuses. And so we drew on each other's strengths in that regard. And when she took a different position, basically then all of the mission became mine to focus on and implement. Luckily, she had trained me well, and I had a fair number of years of exposure to it before I walked into that role. It's not easy to lead a program because the challenges of a program are that you have to continue to hone the mission and support the day-to-day work in living the mission and working it out through the various staff and programs that you have. And at that point, I'm dealing with 4 or 5 staff. I've got 1 or 2 interns or students rolling through there at the same time. And most of that time, I was also the primary supervisor for everyone. Not necessarily the students, but I wasn't usually their first line, but definitely in terms of the other academic staff. And the other tension, I think, that is always the case in a program like that is a financial one, is continuing to seek the funding that is necessary and to make those programs work. And so it's about writing grants. You know, we had a core amount of funds from the Cancer Center that we had to apply for every year. But everything else that we had was money that we had to apply for, you know, and sought and brought in. So there was a lot of, I'm quite a decent writer, so there was a lot of writing that was involved in that. And as a decent writer, I'm an even better editor. I kind of have been known for that. I never got one, but I was threatened several times to get an editor's visor, was going to be coming, a gift from my team. That really changed. And one of the things that happened for me, because I began initially focused on doing American Indian work, and I was doing a lot of community-based work, is that the geography I was working in narrowed to primarily Wisconsin, with a couple of advisory boards that I was serving on to that stretched me beyond there. And then when I became the full-time director, I was doing even less work, direct work, in American Indian community, though I actually worked to have one of my team members assist with that and become part of the efforts that we were doing.
Thank you. So I think since we're about 45 minutes, I think we can hit this fifth question, and that probably will get us, depending on sort of follow-ups, probably sure. get us to where we want. You said yourself that this question was interesting to you, and this is the question about how have changes in technology changed your work?
Well, my tenure at the university basically is in the 2000s. So I came to the university in 2000 and retired just this past year. And what I saw during that time, both changed it for the better and caused frictions that I had, or not frictions, things that I had to particularly coach people to not rely upon. So let me start by talking about what I coach people to not rely upon. So when you're doing cross-cultural work and you're a broker, your personal integrity and your engagement and your relationship building is key. It's, if you will, the coin of the realm, okay? Because without it, nothing's going to happen, okay? And sometimes I've experienced with younger students and younger staff might almost over-rely, well, I sent them an email, and I'm like, okay, have you followed up that email yet? No. And I said, these are very busy people. They're not waiting for you to contact them. So please, you know, follow up. And then it's almost like I had to pull them into picking up a telephone. So it's way important to use the strength of the technology, but not let that technology blind you or inhibit you from being able to do that kind of hand-holding, reach out, go see somebody, talk to them in person, talk to them by phone kind of thing. Because that's going to really, in the end, drive the day. Okay. That said, the tremendous thing that I saw happen is the ability to disseminate information much more broadly and much more quickly. And at least essential information, you know. Sometimes things had to be tailored in particular communities. But that also was further and more easily facilitated. Example, we developed a curriculum called Cancer Clear and Simple. And we have a version that we consider our base version. And then we also tailored it for use in African-American and Latino audiences. And so part of what we were able to do there was the technology helped us to facilitate the ease of forming those different versions. And you could plug and play various kinds of photos that we had developed. And we tried to feature real people, local people, in the materials that we did. And so the other, there's kind of written materials there, but another thing to think about is these lovely little computers we carry around in our back pocket. And because I was working with faculty extensively who were the PI of our program, or who were engaged with us on different research projects that we were working on, those sometimes were very busy people, and the difficulty, you know, so it's easy, much easier for them to reach me via a cell phone and to text me. And so I literally have folks who, if I send them an email, the standard protocol, if I send them the information by email, I needed to text them to let them know that I sent them that email, because they're prioritizing what they're doing, what they're looking at, okay? Or they're calling me to talk to me at 9 p.m. because that's when they can talk to me, okay, in their life, because they're busy physicians. And so the technology has made that possible, and it's also made that kind of work possible, and the additional burdens of that in terms of the time and the energy that it takes to do that, both for on all parties' part.
So I have one follow-up I want to ask from something you said earlier.
Okay.
And then at that point, I think we'll ask for any final thoughts before we wrap up.
Okay.
So you talk about how you describe what you did.
Sure.
And so you said talking to me or other people about describing what you did might be different than talking to a faculty member about what you did.
Right.
So what's the difference?
The difference is really about how much I knew the individual or what their particular interest in asking the question is. So if I perceive that your interest in asking the question is that you just kind of really want to know in a gutsy kind of way, then I'll respond to you that way. But if what you're really asking is founded in whether you might be interested in partnering with us on a research project, then I'm going to answer the question differently. So I'd say something like, well, what we look to do is to figure out what is the particular interests of the research interests of a community, and then partner with individual faculty who may have capacity or expertise and interest in this area. Sometimes that the initiative of that starts the other way, and we have a faculty member who has a particular interest, like you have this particular interest that you were talking to me about. And I think what we can do with that is figure out, is there someone, is there a context in which people might be interested in picking that up and working with that? We need to be prepared to shape that research project in a way that is responsive both to your needs, Doctor, and to the needs of the community partner we're working with. And we'll only discover that over time. You should realize that this requires a certain commitment on your part of just time, because it's not just necessarily going to be a real simple, oh sure, we'll do that, like that, great, just let us know what you need from us. There's likely to be a lot more exchange and a lot more give and take about how that is going to evolve.
Okay, thank you. So I would like to wrap up for the day.
Okay.
We're a little over 50 minutes, but I always like to give the narrator the last word, and by that I mean, are there things that these questions have made you think about that if, when we meet for the follow-up, if you're afraid they may not be on your mind, if you'd like to basically get them on the record right now.
Let me think about that a few seconds here.
Sure.
Can I tell a story?
Please.
So, and this is actually a story that was told to me. There was a researcher who was interested in developing a new research project in a local tribal community. And she had worked with them before, but it had been some time. She had a positive experience, and she thought they did as well. So she followed the protocol and reached out and established an opportunity to go and meet with her contact, who was the health director of the local tribe. And the health director also occasioned an opportunity for her to present her idea to a group of elders in that particular community. As is the case in many tribal communities, a group of elders might actually be the ones who are responsible for agreeing to the conduct of this project, particularly a research project. And so she met, and she had a pleasant conversation with the health director, and she went to the meeting with the health director went with her, and went to the meeting, and proceeded to talk about what it was that she wanted to do. And she talked about who she was and her credentials and the kind of training she had had and why this particular research question was very important and what she would gain from it, what we would learn, what she thought the tribe would benefit from it. So she went on and talked about this. And she got to the end of her remarks, And she said, "Are there any questions?" And the room is silent. Not uncommon. But the silence persisted. And she began to feel a little bit uncomfortable, and she asked the question again, "Are there any questions?" And the silence continued. And she began to sort of move around in her chair and look over at the health director, who was silent. And you could see that she was about ready to ask again. And one of the elders stood up. And he looked at her and he said, "This is all well and good, but if you would please, would you tell us, who are you? Where do you come from? Who are your people? And why are you here?" I tell that story to every colleague of mine that I've worked with professionally on my team. And I suggest to them that they have to be prepared anytime, anywhere, in any community they're working with, to answer those four questions. Who are you? Who are your people? Where do you come from? And why are you here?
Well, I think that's a lovely place to conclude the first session, knowing that I still have half a page worth of questions. So thank you, Rick, for your time today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, today is April 30th, 2020. This is a follow-up interview with Rick Strickland. We are doing this interview remotely because this is during the era of the COVID-19 pandemic. So I'm at home in Madison, Wisconsin, and this interview is being done for our Academic Staff Award Winners Project. So Rick, even though we're doing this remotely, as we did for the first interview, if you could start by saying your name and spelling your last name.
Sure. My name is Rick Strickland, and the last name is spelled Strickland.
Great. And Rick, that that speaking tone right there seems to be perfect. It seems to be landing nicely. So basically, speak like you just did, and we should be able to get you just fine. As I said before we turned on the recorder, Rick, I do have some questions that we didn't get to in that first interview, but I wonder if there's some things that you either said in that first interview that you'd like to either elaborate or clarify before we start to move on to these other questions.
Yes, there actually were. I really appreciated that first interview, and it raised some interesting things for me. And as I thought about the interview, even before I left the building, I actually stopped and made a few notes, which I sort of fleshed out a bit that I would like to cover. I have a bit of a frog in my throat, but try not to let that bother. So one of the things I wanted to talk a little bit about was the relationship with, and what I kind of have learned from so many people with whom I have had pleasure of working or who have been mentors of mine over the course of my professional career. And I guess what I would say is that I learned in my home in early years, I learned what I would describe as a framework of values. But it's the mentors and colleagues and partners, community partners with whom I have worked, that have really helped to flesh that out and fill it in with all kinds of new experiences for me and history that often I had not known. And it's these folks who have taught me to work in what I call a good way. And it would take a bit to unpack that term. It's a term that I first learned from colleagues in Indian country and friends of mine there. And suffice it to say, when they talk about, or when they say that, what they mean in short, is that the manner in which you work is founded on respect, that it acknowledges the otherness of the people with whom you're working, and that you do not necessarily understand what it is that has been their experience or what they're going through. And it sort of starts with you being an honest person and honest about who you are, what you know, and what you don't know, and acknowledge and be willing to acknowledge that you might make a mistake and to ask for help and understanding. So it's this respect kind of is sort of kind of an overarching term to talk about that sort of sense of attitude. And I also have found it helpful to think about this as a willingness to learn. And it helps, I think, if you're genuinely curious. I happen to be a genuinely curious person. And so that has helped me sort of take an attitude of being a learner. And so as I think about that, I think that what I was trying to do or have been trying to do in my professional life at the university was really to leave one foot in the institution and put one foot in a community setting and try to find a way that we could work together that's first and foremost built the capacity of that community partner. And that fundamentally is the sort of key way to, I think, understand at least what I sought to do in my professional life at the university.
Great. Thank you for that, Rick. So I'd like to move to the questions that I didn't get to ask last time, understanding that if there are things that you want to add, feel free to at any point. So the next question on that list of questions was, were you involved in academic staff governance or groups?
Okay. My work often had me involved in a variety of groups and that were community-based, and it was really fundamental to the work that I did, the core. Like, you couldn't really do what I did without having a variety of community partners and organizations with which you worked. There were some things that went on in a more continuous basis where I was regularly for a number of years involved with particular community organizations or statewide organizations or even national ones. And so I'm going to speak to that. I was not active in staff governance, formal staff governance at the university, but I did become involved in some university or campus-based groups. So I would like to say something about those before I illustrate some of the ongoing off-campus ones. The specifically tied to the American Indian-related work that I did, I was involved in something called the Indigenous Health and Wellness Day. This is an annual event that was sponsored on campus, and it's actually an event for junior high and high school American Indian students to introduce them to the opportunities related to a career in health, either as a health professional or as a scientist. And this is something that's been going on campus for between, I would say, around 15, maybe even more years, somewhere between 15 and 18 years. And I've been on the planning committee for that, I actually still am. And this year's event was postponed in relationship to COVID-19 and actually canceled. So we will re-up again in the spring for 2020. But that is an event that I was involved in. And the lead organization sponsoring that event now is an organization inside the School of Medicine and Public Health called the Native American Center for Health Professions. And this is an organization that was founded by a person who I knew who was on faculty here. And I had some association with folks who were in the founding of this event, of this organization. And I've continued to have a variety of different kinds of relationships to them. For example, most recently, they submitted a renewal grant, and I had helped read and edit the original grant that funded the organization and through the Indian Health Service. And I also played a minor role in helping to look at this renewal grant, which was also successful. Toward the end of my career, I became involved literally in the last couple of years with a couple of other efforts on campus that kind of an outgrowth of some of the work that I had done. The Mortgage Center currently has a tenure and promotion committee that it is sponsoring, that is working to explore how to support faculty who are pursuing a tenure package under what's called an integrated case model. It relates to people who participate in community-based participatory research and who actively are engaged with building relationships with community organizations, and how to evaluate the outcome of that research from a tenure perspective. And it's been a very important learning experience for me to be involved in that. And that is also something that I continue to do now as a retired person. Finally, the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Educational Achievement has recently formed in the past year or year and change an advisory committee or advisory council. And I was asked to serve on that and have been doing so both a little bit before I retired and now in retirement. So those are some ways in which I have been involved, well, not directly in academic staff governance, have been involved in on-campus based efforts and continue to be. From an off-campus perspective, I made the point earlier that I'm consistently involved with various community organizations, ranging from organizations here in town called, you know, like the Black Women's Wellness Foundation, Central Hispano, 100 Black Men of Madison, et cetera. And in the state, a variety of different other community groups that were based in rural communities that we served. From an ongoing perspective, my greatest sort of consistent involvement has been, again, with American Indian related efforts and organizations. So the Spirit of Eagles program that actually was we were contracted to be part of through the National Spirit of Eagles effort, which was funded through the National Cancer Institute, and we were a contracted party in that, have a national network that included people like myself who were program staff working on the effort, as well as faculty, Native faculty and non-Native faculty from around the country who were involved in cancer control related efforts. And that group still has some structure right now, even though it has lost its funding. Last year, we actually convened. I don't know whether we usually convene in the fall and in the spring, and this spring meeting was canceled. I don't know whether what will transpire, but it was basically a place to strategize about program development and funding, and to talk about initiatives that were impacting cancer control in American Indian communities across the country, and was an exciting opportunity for me to meet scholars and people, academics, non-academics, who are really actively engaged in addressing that issue. I also have been involved the Great Lakes Intertribal Council here in, which is based in Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin, and specifically the Native American Research Center for Health, where I have served in, on the advisory committee for that effort in, throughout my career at the university. We also developed something called the Share the Care American Indian Cancer Conference. It's one of the only, in fact, I think it's still maybe the only statewide American Indian Cancer Conference in the United States. And we formed a coalition of tribal representatives and state and advocacy organization representatives to sponsor that conference every year. And I was asked to actually speak this year. It's usually held in the spring, and it too was canceled in light of COVID-19. So those were some examples of some ongoing things that I've been involved in. They all have kind of really taught me, provided me with a great learning about the communities that they were serving, and the also how I could be most effective as an ally. And I think that's an ongoing thing to learn, how as a white man, I can partner effectively and be an ally to efforts that are really led by people who are of the particular community that we're engaged in. So that's what I was going to offer in relationship to my involvement in groups and academic staff-related activities on campus.
Great. Thank you. So my next question then is, and you talked about this a little bit, I think, when in the last interview when you talked about how you talk to a faculty member about what you do, but I want to ask directly about this question. Do you think about the relationship between faculty and staff? And then if so, you know, what are your thoughts?
Yes, I do, and I have, and it's pretty unavoidable in my work. Professionally, I was actively engaged with faculty on a regular basis, particularly in grant writing, research development, and regularly I partnered with faculty in developing community partnerships where they would conduct research in partnership with a community organization. And so often I was sort of the broker of that relationship. And so part of my job was to attend to the concerns and interests of the faculty person and the concerns and interests of the community representative or the community organization, the representatives of that organization who were involved. And one of the things that, as you can imagine, sometimes that those interests might not necessarily be the same, and that part of what my job was to do was to ensure that we found common ground that ultimately where we ended up was in the interest of that community organization and would support their goals. Because it's very easy to do something that's commonly called helicopter research, where the faculty person involved sort of helicopters in to a community and asks questions and gets information and takes that away and does whatever they want to do with that, but not really have any feedback loop, not really have any foundation in that community in such a way that what that process did actually contributed to the well-being of that community. And that is sort of the antithesis to what we wanted to do in this relationship. So when I talked earlier about willingness to learn, that same principle applies here. And so part of what the funny way we talked about it was sort of a litmus paper test that we would apply to prospective faculty partners. And really it comes down to, can you learn? And by that, I mean, can you willing to be a person, be self-reflective, and to operate from a perspective that honors the otherness of the folks with whom you're working and recognizes and respects the fact that their experience may not be yours, and that your role is also to listen and to understand so that you can construct something that is mutually beneficial. I'm well aware that there are, you know, different things that different objectives that a faculty member might bring to something, and they too obviously have, as we talked a little bit earlier, you know, have to be aware that they're going to be judged for tenure, and how does what they're doing apply to and further their own professional career. But it's my experience that you can weave those things together and do so in a responsible way. And that was part of what we tried to do. A university is a very hierarchical institution, and we all have the influence and power we have as individuals, and the influence and power we have because of the position or role we occupy in that institution. And it's all about how you use that, how you use that power and for whom. My grandfather was fond of a saying, and if I heard this once, I don't know how many times I heard it, he would look at me and say, "Grandson, remember, they put their pants on one leg at a time too." And clearly, he was trying to suggest something to me about how not to be afraid of somebody who might have a position of power or authority, and to recognize that they're a human being too. And I think that it's important sometimes, sometimes it's easy to get consumed by your role or your position, or to not recognize the power you have simply because you are a member of an institution, you are a faculty person, you are an academic staff person like me. And to acknowledge that and to be aware of that and to understand that your own person, how you act as a person, that there also is how the institution acts that you're associated with. And so I think for very deeply somewhere, thanks to my grandfather, I have sort of started eschewing arrogance at a very young age. My children, my family, my wife, most anyone who knows me knows that it is probably the thing that will tick me off the quickest. So I think it's just always being aware of that dynamic. And because of my work, it was sort of constitutive and of the day to day.
Great, thank you. I can't remember who espoused that phrase onto me, but I've heard that phrase quite a bit in my life too. I'm not sure whether it's helped me as much as it seems to have been a good mantra for you, but thank you for reminding me of it. So I'm moving now to the award, the reason why we're interviewing you, and that's the Academic Staff Award. There's sort of three questions here, so I'm going to ask them one at a time. The answers will obviously depend, the length of the answers will depend on, you know, however you choose to respond to them. But the first question is, did you know you were nominated?
Yes, I knew I was nominated. I actually was nominated three times and received the award the third time. The first time, I didn't have much of a role in that process. The second and third time, I did have more of a role.
So then the second question is your thoughts or reactions when you heard that you had received the award.
I chuckled because I need to tell you the story of when I was told. So I had arranged a meeting with our faculty, our PI, Dr. Tracy Downs, in early February of the year in which I received the award. And before I could get to my agenda that I had planned, he said, "Wait, I have something that I need to share with you." And so he read this email, and I was a bit taken aback because I had thought a lot about what my agenda was that I was raising with him. The purpose of the meeting that I had arranged was for me to tell him that I was making plans to retire. And in the midst of that, I'm being told about this. And the funny part of the story is, Dr. Downs has a fine sense of humor, and he said we had a very fine working relationship. And he said to me, "So if I call them up and ask them to delay and give you the award next year, will you stay another year?" And I laughed and I said, "No." So it was kind of this bittersweet moment of sort of how that came about. I think the other part about that that's important to know is it was really the only UW recognition that I ever had said to someone that I really wanted. And I said that to my wife. And I saw it as a way of validating, not only for me, but for my unit, the Cancer Health Disparities Initiative, validating the kind of work we did and how we did it. And often the ways in which we had worked were not well understood, or often not well supported or recognized. And so from my perspective, it was sort of like an icing, and I was glad that it occurred and happened before I was no longer on staff, and in a situation where I could also leave that as a legacy for the unit itself, that it had been recognized in that way.
So before I ask about your thoughts about the reception itself, it's interesting that you wanted to make sure you say you validated the work, because you were kind enough to give me your comments. And I think your comments, you know, after thanking people, were very much not about you, but about the work itself.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right, because, you know, we have to understand that from my point of view, I'm an agent. I'm an agent of a mission, and I tried to do my best, but I'm only one person, and I'm trying to leverage the work of many people. From my point of view, I think that that's just honest. That's not an effort at false humility. That's just being honest about what it takes to really make for change. And from my point of view, I felt really good about that, you know, and about the remarks I made. I actually had someone, kind of reach out to me, and several people actually, but I was thinking of one who started that process, but reach out to me and thank me for my remarks. It really mattered to me. I think the reception was fun, because some of the people who were able to be there were people who had been part of that effort, as well as the people who had written the letters of support were longstanding colleagues and partners in helping get things done.
Thank you. So you alluded to the reception there. It was great to see the people who had supported you or supported the work there. Any other thoughts about the reception itself?
I thought it was quite a nice event. It was interesting to me to hear the breadth and see the breadth of people, of awardees, and what they were about. The nature of the height of an award is that we tend to be the folks who are kind of out in the community, among the other awardees. But I found it very interesting to hear their stories. There's a funny remembrance about the reception. So I'm called up for the award, and we're sort of two thirds of the way through the evening, and Chancellor Blank reaches out her hand to shake my hand, and I just gave her a hug. And I realized afterwards, I said, "Oh my God, I just hugged the chancellor," it was sort of a colleague of mine, Patrick Sims, says, "Well, that's how we roll, don't worry about it, that kind of thing." I found it a fun event, and it was some of the lead up to it, the initial marketing about what it was that my work was about, I had to kind of tone it down. There were things about sort of saved lives because it was about cancer, and I was like, so if you think about that in relationship to my orientation to the sense of mission and that we all have a role, you can imagine that when I first saw some of those words, I had to kind of work on that script that was emailed to me. That was kind of fun in itself.
Great. Thank you. So actually I want to, since we're here at this time, before I move to legacy, I want to ask, I'm sorry I didn't prep you for this, but I want to talk a little bit about this pandemic,
okay.
And just maybe to get your thoughts about how it's affected you, how it's affected your family, and then maybe if you want to talk about you mentioned when we were off the mic, if you will, about we're all figuring out, we're all learning about public health. But anyway, however you may want to talk about COVID-19 and the pandemic.
Hmm. Well, it is a really interesting thing. I respect the people in Wisconsin who are finding it difficult to live under the stay-at-home order that has been recently extended by Governor Evers. Because there are differences in terms of the extent of exposure that and number of cases and serious cases in different parts of the state. The truth of the matter really though is that could also just be the sort of the stage at which the disease has really reached those areas in those communities. And it's also related to, obviously, the density of the population in a particular region of the state. Fundamentally, though, we are really all in, the talk about we are all in this together is, yes, we are. We are all in this together. And what's unique about this virus is that it is very serious, and particularly serious for older people. And that's a little bit of a difference in terms of people who are older, whose bodies have lived longer and are experienced more wear and tear, literally, and who have underlying conditions, are always more susceptible to coronaviruses. And flu-related viruses, but the some of the severity here is quite extreme, and we simply don't know how to treat it. We're still learning, and we have no vaccine. So that's why this is what it is in terms of having this kind of restrictions on ourselves. I think it's also been a huge learning time, about the interdependence that we have as people living in a space, in a, on a street, in a town, in a countryside. I'm an old rural kid, and the importance of relationship and support to neighbors is a really critical thing. It's drilled into me. And when I think it's really important to recognize that the best way in which we can support our neighbors and our friends is to maintain that social distance, and to figure out ways that we can offer over the fence, if you will, some measure of uplift and support as we walk through this. Many people facing significant economic kinds of impact. I'm fortunate, I'm a retired person, and so I'm not experiencing those significant losses of income. And I'm happy to see that we are finally getting some support to folks that, and more needs to happen in that regard. But before we're able to really dial this down, we're going, in terms of the way the restrictions that we're living under, before we're able to dial this down, we have to be able to more broadly test people, and we have to be able to follow up on cases where we identify someone who has the virus. We have to figure out who they have been in contact with so that we can enforce isolation, so we really stop the spread of the disease. So I think, again, I think it's been a very important learning time because we have experienced these interdependencies that we really do have with each other. And I'm hopeful that post this event and experience, that how we go about our day-to-day living may see some revision and may be informed by a better understanding, a fuller understanding of how interdependent we really are.
Thank you. I put you on the spot there. That was a very nice nice response, so I appreciate that. So now I'm nearing the end, if you will, and that's my final questions are about legacy. It's kind of a two-part question, or how I ask it anyway. So the first part, I'm going to ask them both. The first part is, what do you feel you'll be remembered for? And is that what you want to be remembered for?
It's interesting that the way in which you structured that question, Troy, because I don't experience a lot of dissonance. I think that there'll be a fairly a high degree of correspondence between what I would like to be remembered for and what people will indeed remember me for. I'm sure that's what I'm chuckling about is that I'm sure whoever's doing the remembering what they remember will be conditioned by who they are and what their experience was and their role. And some of the students and interns and folks who we've worked with, I had a habit of often saying, you know, my objective here is to influence your thinking. So the stories that people may tell, I shudder to think what all they may be. But I think to go to your point, I think I'll be remembered first as a person who was committed to what I believed, and who was determined, sometimes maybe to a fault, in terms of being an advocate for particular views and practices that I thought were respectful and honored the experience of others. I think I'll be sort of remembered as a champion, somebody who, well, I guess I said that in terms of an advocate, but I think also that I was thoughtful and a strategic thinker. I can remember several staff that I've worked with who commented about that off and on throughout many different years of my work. I think that I'll be remembered as an honest ally, as someone who really took that task to heart and made a sincere effort, and a mentor. I've invested a fair amount here, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years, in mentorship roles with staff, junior staff, as well as with students and interns, some of whom are now out practicing physicians here and there, or scientists in their own right. It's a very proud reflection I have to think about the many ways in which some of the former students and interns and junior staff are now in positions and making an impact using the skills that they have. I think I'll also be remembered as a playful storyteller, kind of an amateur philosopher, and that I was good with words, probably both verbally and as an editor as well. It was threatened on several occasions to get me an editor's visor, and people have said things like, "Oh my God, I got back something that I asked, I wrote that Rick was to edit, and there were only 3 or 4 notations, and I was going to frame it." Yeah. I think that's probably on the list too.
All right, thank you. Thank you for all that. So now I leave it to you if there are any final thoughts or anecdotes that you feel like you'd like to tell before we wrap up this session, and which would wrap up the oral history too.
Okay. Well, I would just say that it's been a pleasure. It's been to be asked to reflect on these questions. I feel very honored that to be asked to participate. I think that it's been fun to get to know you, Troy, through this process. I think I've done, especially since I took some time to make some additional comments at the beginning, I think I'm quite satisfied with what I've had the opportunity to share.
Okay. So I'm sure we'll chat for a minute or two after we officially sign off, but this is the official sign off. So this concludes the follow-up session and the oral history with Rick Strickland. Rick, thank you so much for the time that you've given me. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome.